Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to start off the morning learning about a program that gives St. Michael's College students a leg up. Then we'll meet one last candidate for before the August 9th primary, and we'll spend the 10 o'clock hour meeting a whole host of Vermonters who were photographed by Ethan Hubbard and to whom they shared their many stories. But let's start at St. Mike's and learn how students there are enhancing their own stories before they graduate. Joining me now is Todd Johnstone Wright. He's the school's director of undergraduate professional endorsement. And Todd, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. It's great to be here.
Good morning. Great to have you. Listeners, to ask Todd about the program, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Todd, I'm going to take this through a few steps to get to what's happening today at St. Mike's, but I want you to start off by explaining what the Wilderness Program is or was at St. Mike's.
Well, the Wilderness Program, now currently called the Adventure Sports Program,
right,
it's essentially set up like a guide service for the college where we recruit and train undergraduate students and then train them to national standards in a variety of disciplines: whitewater kayaking, coastal kayaking, rock climbing, ice climbing, backcountry skiing, mountain biking. And then in turn, they guide on the weekends or instruct on the weekends. And so I was the director of the Adventure Sports Center for 25 years, and now it's in the very capable hands of my former assistant director, now the director, Evan Woodland. And it's kind of a unique program because it really transcends the traditional outing club model and works more on a professional / certification model. And it serves a massive population. St. Mike's is a very small school, and it annually about 2/3 of the campus participates in some type of outdoor program through the Adventure Sports Center. So it's hugely popular, which kind of fits because it's very much part of adventure sport and outdoor recreation is very much part of the Vermont brand. I really look at it after 25 years as being both unique and kind of a gem amongst other kind of outdoor programs in the college and university world.
When did that all get started? You said you were in charge for 25 years.
Yes. So it started in 1996. And it started when I completed my undergraduate degree at St. Mike's. I was a non-traditional student. I was in the military prior to coming to the college. And during my time in the military, I really got into rock climbing and mountaineering and was working professionally when I got out of the military as a rock climbing guide. And I worked as a guide all 4 years through college. The timing was right, I guess, where St. Mike's was ready to make a change. And they asked me if I wanted to dedicate about 2 years to getting a program up and operational. And then 25 years later, I was putting my stuff in a box and leaving my office. So it was a pretty good run.
And in addition to rock climbing, aren't you an expert in kayaking?
Well, yes. So I transitioned around 2000 from – I still climb recreationally, and I really enjoy it, but I transitioned away from climbing and started both whitewater and coastal kayaking, and it, for some reason that just really clicked. And so I am I'm a professional paddler. I paddle for P&H Custom Sea Kayaks, and I'm an ambassador for Northwest River Supply, or NRS equipment, and I'm a British canoeing coach and an American Canoe Association instructor, trainer, educator. So I travel around the country, actually around the world. I spent a lot of time in Croatia and the United Kingdom, developing both instructors and coaches in whitewater and coastal kayaking. So that's kind of my new outdoor passion, if you will.
Incredible. All right. We're going to transition to now from the Adventure Sports Center to something called undergraduate professional endorsement program, or I guess UPE for short. What exactly is this?
So, if you a little bit of a backstory. So it kind of originated out of the Adventure Sports Center. We realized that the vast majority of our student instructors that were graduating from the Adventure Sports Center were actually graduating, and despite having a relatively high level of professional credentialing in outdoor pursuits or adventure sport, the vast majority of them, actually almost all of them, weren't working in that industry. Instead, they were going to graduate school or going into medicine or becoming nurse practitioners or working in some type of organizational structure. But the feedback that we were getting from those alumni is that that professional credentialing, that training, that putting theory into practice through the Adventure Sports Center was incredibly valuable. And I really saw a disconnect there. We're training students to do a thing, but they're saying that that thing translates to a variety of different organizations. So that's kind of where the conversation got started, was St. Mike's, because it is small, is very unique, where we have students that are working side by side alongside professionals in almost every context at the college, and trying to figure out a way to kind of codify and formalize that training or that experience. And that's kind of where the conversation originated, was we have these students doing, engaging in this highly professional practice over 4 years. But when it comes time to put it on their resume, it might just look like an activity or a campus job. And it really transcends that activity or campus job. And then we also realized at the same time that we have students working in all these different professional contexts, but there wasn't very much structural alignment structural alignment between them. So while they were all probably bumping into or learning similar skills and developing similar professional competencies, we didn't have any kind of control over that content or over that curriculum. And that's where this idea came from, of how can we have that consistency, that curricular kind of fidelity of what students are learning when it comes to professionalism and working in organizations, and then couple that with, you know, valuable professional credentialing, things that they need when they leave the college and go into that big world. And I think one of the things we really need to think about in higher education is I'm a product of the liberal arts. I'm a firm believer in the liberal arts. But most undergraduate students, they don't graduate with an undergraduate degree and then get paid to think great thoughts or, you know.
I do.
Sit in a library and read.
Yeah.
Instead, they go and they take that knowledge and understanding and those abilities, and they place them into context. And that professional context is an organization. And whether you're working in for-profit or nonprofit, the educational sector, no matter where you're working, organizations share a common DNA. And that's what we really have been focusing on, is how do we prepare students to make that transition into those professional contexts and be as successful as possible right out of the gates. So instead of, you know, walking into a profession, they're at a quick job or a full run into that profession.
So Todd, when did it become an actual program?
We're just rounding, technically as of July 1, but I started working on the program in April 2021. So we're slightly over a year into the program right now.
And in what areas can someone take? Do they take a UPE or get credit for a UPE? You mentioned the Action Sports Center or Adventure Sports Center, which has been, you know, going for since 1996. But I'm guessing that's not the only UPE.
Oh, no. So we currently are offering professional endorsements in adventure sports coaching, emergency medical services, leadership, nonprofit management, organizational management, sports coaching, so competitive sports coaching, sustainable management, and we just added a new one, managing change in resolving conflict. And we're also currently working on one around copy editing because we have a lot of students that work in our writing support center, and they develop this incredibly robust skill of not only, proofing and copy editing, but really teaching or coaching people to be better writers, which is pretty valuable in the professional context. So that's one that hopefully will be online this year.
That makes my heart go pitter-pat. I was a copy editor in the sports department of the Miami Herald back in grad school and beyond, and so I love hearing that. What kind of time commitment is there by the student for a UPE?
So great question, and it really depends on the UPE. They all share a common framework. So students participate in two credit classes that bookend the experience. So the first two credit class at the beginning of their experience is called Professionalism, Theory and Practice for a Global Workplace. And what that focuses on is core professional competencies. Now, it's kind of an interesting class. It isn't, I currently teach it, and if you were to walk into it on a Wednesday evening, it would probably not look like what you would expect. And so it's built on a community of practice model, which is really valuable for folks going and working in organizations. And students, we spend the first couple of classes looking at, how industry defines professional competencies. What do employers consider professional competencies? And, we kind of get those out in the open. And then we have students have a conversation about what's missing. What have they pulled from their experience, from their current professional practice that they think matters that isn't on that list? And that really forms the foundation of our curriculum for the semester. And I lead between four to five of the sessions. And then the remaining sessions are kind of curated and developed by the students in the class. And they're not lecture-based. They're very activity-based. So they would take the shape of a professional training. So if you were to have a professional training come into your organization and say, hey, we're going to do a professional training on conflict resolution, that person's going to probably give you a little bit of underpinning theory and some information, and then they're going to jump into a lot of activity. What does this look like in a professional context? How does it work? And that's how the class is built. And so you have these students that are delivering these 40-minute sessions on a variety of different topics that are either close to their heart or they think are really valuable. And that's what magic. So it's as an educator, it's a really unique experience where it's that gradual release of responsibility. By the halfway point of the semester, I'm just another student in the class. I'm on the learning journey with everyone else. And the topics are incredibly diverse. Like we had a student that did a 40-minute session on stoicism as a philosophy for folks working in organizations. Wow. So, that doesn't pop up a lot in the undergraduate world. And, but it was absolutely brilliant. And he had developed all these scenarios of things that had happened in, his summer jobs when he was in high school and playing hockey and, these things that have emerged, these situations, and how would a Stoic approach those? And why is that potentially beneficial? Why is that approach beneficial to someone who is working and managing or leading others? And it was very much about controlling the things that you can control and not dedicating a lot of emotional energy to the things that you can't control. It was an absolutely brilliant session.
Yeah.
Again, it's coming from them versus coming from me.
So Todd, I want to take a quick break here, and then we're going to get back to this. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. If you graduated from college more than 20 years ago, you'd probably be amazed at what students today are accomplishing during their undergraduate years. We're speaking with Todd Johnstone Wright of St. Michael's College about the school's undergraduate professional endorsement program. And if you'd like to ask Todd about it, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Todd, before the break, we were talking about the time commitment. You mentioned there are two credit hour classes at the beginning and end, but you know, how many hours a week does a student commit to this and over how many semesters?
So, good question. And it depends on the student and their level of professional engagement. So at a minimum, students need to be engaged in some campus-based initiative or office. So they need to be connected with an organization like Fire Rescue or the Adventure Sports Center or our mobilizational volunteer effort or working in the Writing Center. So those students could be working in those areas anywhere from 2 to 10 to 15 hours a week. And that's the foundation, their professional practice. In addition, they need to seek out a professional credential, some type of relevant professional credential. And we work with a variety of certifying bodies for students to achieve or obtain those credentials. And those could be a professional credential in conflict resolution and mediation. And often those credentialing or those certifications are self-paced and e-learning. And then at the end of the process, they do that second two-credit course, which is really a portfolio course. It's an opportunity for them to come together as a community, and they're over that semester, they're required to do a minimum of 20 hours of practicum where they pull something from their credentialing or their certification and put it into practice. So they tease out some bit of theory or some type of action item from their learning, and then they put it into a professional context and really just see if it works. And the
next can you give an example of one of those? I think that'd be really interesting.
Cool. So we had a student this semester who has a professional who received a professional certificate in managing change and resolving conflict. And she also works for Resonance Life as a resident assistant. And so she took, she looked at two specific types of mediation or two specific ways of mediating conflict. And then she used those with that mediation structure with resolving conflict on two of the floors she oversaw. So she had kind of like she had a control group and you know what she normally does, and on the other floor she managed, she put these two new approaches into practice. And then she, at the end of the process, she surveyed all of her residents and said, "Hey, what worked? What didn't work? Why did it work? Is it effective?" So that's one example. And another example is a young woman who was fortunate enough during her senior year to be able to coach basketball in Vermont. So she was coaching JV women's basketball locally. Mm-hmm. And she did a professional endorsement in sports coaching and got really engaged in self-determination theory. It had to motivate athletes. So she focused the entirety of her season as using self-determination theory as kind of an underpinning part of her coaching, and then gathered information from her athletes throughout the season of, you know, how did her behaviors as a coach impact their development, impact their learning, impact their love and joy of the sport. So those are just two kind of quick examples of students putting theory into practice.
I'm sure people wonder about this, and I'm sure listeners are wondering. I'm starting to get the idea, but how does a UPE differ from, say, an internship, which many places offer?
Great. So they are not designed to replace an internship. So internships are often a much longer time commitment, and they're very broad. And the other challenge with internships is the college or university sending a student off for an internship may not have a lot of direct control over the content or what the type of work that the student is engaged in. Mm-hmm. And which is a good thing. Whereas this is a little bit more laser focused, where we want students exploring a very specific area and then putting that very specific thing into a professional context. And I think that it makes sense because that is how we continue to develop as professionals. So, you know, in your professional life, when you get jammed up or something isn't working, you probably reflect on it, you unpack it, you figure out what you need to learn, and then you take that learning, that self-directed learning, and put it into practice. You may not go and take a formal class, or but you're an active learner. You figure out how to learn more to succeed, to continue to develop as a professional. And we want students to be practiced at that before they enter that professional space. So that's kind of how it differs from a internship.
At what point in someone's college career will they take a UPE at St. Mike's?
Ideally, our target audience is sophomores. And that seems quite early because, you know, it's their second year of college, and they might be still trying to figure it out. But quite often with sophomores, you know, that's when we want them to really start working on their plan, start thinking about kind of the future, and kind of putting things in order in a very constructive alignment way towards graduation. So sophomore year is an excellent time to start. In general, a student can technically complete a UPE in two semesters. On average, I suspect as the program grows and develops, it'll be most students will finish a UPE in three semesters, just from a time commitment standpoint. So if we're working with predominantly sophomores, that means by the beginning or middle of their junior year, they actually have already completed something. They've achieved something. They've achieved a professional credential, and they've received an endorsement before they've even completed the requirements for the major or minor. So ideally, we want them starting around their sophomore year. Because we're a new program, the vast majority of the folks that did it this year were seniors, and they all completed it in two semesters, which was impressive, the amount of work they put in to complete something in two semesters. Because some of the certification courses, particularly the in-person certification courses, are anywhere from 40 to 60 hours.
We've got 30 seconds left. Is this happening all over the country, or is St. Mike's one of a few, or maybe the only offering it?
It is happening in different places. Tons of colleges and universities have been trying to figure out how to maximize and capitalize on professional credentialing, and it hasn't been incredibly successful, and I think it's because it hasn't been embedded in the structure, and that's what St. Mike's is doing differently. We've taken those professional credentials and we've embedded them in the structure, and we've also provided opportunities for students to put them into real-time practice.
Todd Johnstone Wright is the director of the Undergraduate Professional Endorsement Program at St. Michael's College. And to learn more, you can visit smcvt.edu. Todd, thanks so much for sharing this information with us this morning.
No problem, Rick. It was an absolute pleasure.
All right, take care. We're going to go to a break for CBS News, get an update, then come back and meet Democratic gubernatorial candidate Brenda Siegel. And coming up today at 1, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, followed by 2 hours of the getaway with the pride of Plainfield, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. We've been spending the past few weeks getting to know the candidates you'll be seeing on your August 9th primary ballot. It's time now to meet Brenda Siegel of New Fane, who's running in the Democratic primary for governor. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Brenda about where she stands on the issues facing our state, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Brenda Siegel, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Brenda, start us off telling us a bit about your educational career and political background.
Sure. I've been a teacher for a long time, working in both teaching dance and teaching leadership, civic engagement, and social justice in schools. In addition to that, I have done advocacy work. I started my political work as an intern in Bernie Sanders' office in my 20s in D.C., and I have continued to do advocacy work throughout, but in the last many years, I've been doing a lot on around housing and the overdose crisis, both in the state and around the country, with some pretty grand successes in terms of very hard and controversial work.
Why do you want to be governor of Vermont?
We have systems in our agencies that need to change in order to be more efficient and more effective for the people of Vermont. People in this state are struggling, and we need to do more to make sure that they have a path not only to survive but also thrive in our state.
So, Brenda, what makes you uniquely qualified to lead this state?
So the work that I've done has been on the ground. I've also experienced the hardships that many Vermonters across the state have faced. And also, I have worked inside the legislature on very complicated policy where we've been able to have strong tripartisan support as the legislation passes. So this is not polarizing because we're able to sit at the table until the work is done. And right now what's missing from our administration is the ability to stay at the table until the work is done. And that's why we're seeing so many vetoes.
What will be your priorities if you become governor of Vermont?
When I'm going across the state, the thing that I'm hearing the most, and it's what I work on, is that the housing shortage is detrimental. It is detrimental to our main streets. It is detrimental to people living in poverty. And frankly, it doesn't matter whether you are experiencing homelessness or upper middle class. There is nowhere to go in this state to live. And so we can't just have a plan that looks good on paper. It has to include emergency, transitional, and permanent housing structures, and it has to assess and meet need. We also have to heal the overdose crisis. It is impacting every single one of our communities, and in fact, in the last year, our rural communities were hit the hardest. We have to focus on harm reduction first, treatment and recovery on demand, including medically assisted treatment on demand, dual diagnosis support, and criminal justice reform if we want to see that change. The last 6 years, we have seen the most increase and the most death in the history of our state, and more increase than other parts of the country by a lot. And so when we see that, we know that we have to make change. We also see that the climate crisis is deeply impacting especially people struggling the most in our state, and we see those bills being vetoed, and we have to move forward on them. It also will save Vermonters money if we move forward. So those are the really important issues. And then if we talk about the economy, we have to build it from the bottom up. We have to make sure that we are supporting and our teachers and state employees. They're the heroes of our time, and we need to make sure that we are respecting and supporting them.
Looking at the most recent legislative session, what were some of the items that got passed that you would have supported and signed?
Sure. So the housing bill, S-226, was actually the bill that we asked for while we were sleeping on the State House steps to demand that the governor reinstate the program that emergency housed people experiencing homelessness. That bill got stripped some of the policies around low and moderate income because it otherwise wouldn't have been signed. So I would have signed it, and I would have signed it with those protections in place that would have advanced all Vermonters to have access to housing. In addition, there were some bills that were vetoed that I would have signed, and so I think that that's really important. There was the overdose crisis response bill would have increased access to treatment, which would have made our communities safer. That bill was vetoed over a study that was in it. I would have signed that bill.
You've mentioned housing several times. What more can be done to address the need for housing, in particular affordable housing, in the state of Vermont?
Sure. In places where they have been successful at both ending homelessness but also just increasing access to housing for low and moderate income people, which our state is mostly made up of low and moderate income folks. So I think that's really important to understand. They have required new builds to have 25% low-income access to housing and to have more supports in place so that emergency housing ends up just a very temporary step to a transitional housing with wraparound support services and then permanent housing. We know that these new builds are not going to be built tomorrow. So we have to make sure that we are creating a plan that ensures that more people don't end up on the street. When we were working on the emergency housing program, we met several people who were in the middle income or upper middle income category and were families and living in their cars because they didn't have access to the housing market. So this is not just a low income problem anymore. It's because we do not have housing in the state. And so if we don't have that transitional step, we are not going to succeed at solving this problem.
ARPA funds going away, Brenda. So how do we have the ability to address this housing crisis?
Sure. So one of the problems that we have is that we always look at the short-term economic gain instead of the long-term economic gain. And where that has landed us is where we are right now, which is with a major housing shortage. So we need to do, again, an assessment of need and do an evaluation of what the cost is of staying where we are right now versus solving the problem. So there may be an upfront cost, but if in the long term we actually solve this issue, it will reduce the economic impact on Vermonters and the economic impact on our state.
You mentioned that the overdose crisis, definitely one of your top priorities. I know the opioid abuse epidemic in the state is one you care very deeply about. So let's go a little deeper there. What steps by the state still need to be taken to finally bring this under control?
Right. So like I said before, we have to focus on harm reduction first, treatment and recovery on demand, including medically assisted treatment on demand, dual diagnosis support, and criminal justice reform. What that means is we need to ensure that we are meeting people where they are and addressing the crisis itself. So the people that are struggling right now, which is is between 20 and 30,000 in our state with substance use disorder, with opioid use disorder, we need to make sure that we are meeting them where they are to help them have access to treatment, to create a system where they feel worthy of life, and to ensure that their mental health is addressed and taken care of. Because when we are able to secure that, then we reduce demand as well, which also reduces supply. So it is really important, essential, in fact, that we stop burying our children and that we do the work that is based on the science and data that will help to stop this crisis. We can't continue to use drug war policies because those drug war policies are causing exactly what we're seeing today.
Let's take a call from Fred, who joins us from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Would you be in favor of having a constitutional convention in which we could amend the Second Amendment to eliminate assault weapons?
So constitutional conventions are complicated, especially in a country where we have so many states who are willing to actually take away our liberties. There are risks there. I 100% support eliminating the use of people killers of military assault rifles. They should not be on our street, and I completely support doing whatever it takes to get that done. I just want us to make sure that we're clear about whether or not we're going to be risking more access to reproductive liberty, contraception, whether we're going to be risking same-sex marriage, whether we're going to be in marriage equality, whether we're going to be risking transgender rights. We have to be really cautious as we move forward because it kind of opens up the whole barrel.
Brenda, how would you address the great need in the state for workforce development?
Right. So, again, I know that I keep harping on this, but we have to address housing. in as part of this crisis. Right now, we have people who come to the state for jobs and can't stay because there's nowhere for them to live. And so that is actually like ground zero for this work. In addition to that, we need to make sure that we're not just making accessible, but talking to our youth as they go in higher education about other options around trades, because that's extremely important. And what I'm hearing around the state is that the trades are deeply suffering. We also have to address how student loans play out for the same folks, because when we're talking about nursing, when we're talking about childcare, when we're talking about all of those issues, we have to ensure that those that people are not going in deeply into debt to address our workforce shortage. And then finally, if we're looking at things like where we see deep gaps, which is early childhood and nursing and medical professionals, that we have to look at what we're paying folks and our willingness to have things like paid family and medical leave. If we don't have a paid family and medical leave system for teachers, for folks who are oftentimes majority women, then we can't actually address this workforce shortage at all. And so we have to look at a livable wage and paid family medical leave, and we need to support our main streets in transitioning to those things, and we need to require large businesses to transition, because right now our main streets are carrying the brunt of that transition, which has happened naturally as part of COVID, and that's not fair or equitable. However, we also want to make sure that people continue or even grow more into being paid what they are worth. People are valued in the work they do. People are not here just to make our workforce stronger. They are here to make a brighter and stronger state, and we need to value them the same way that we value our businesses. And so we can do both together. It isn't either or, it's both and.
During the pandemic, the need for broadband statewide certainly came forward, and this has been something the state has struggled with for years. How do we get that done?
The broadband. Yep. So there is a huge there was a huge investment in broadband this last session, and my understanding is we're going to see a huge bump much faster than most of our other policies because of the investment. However, because of the cost of labor and the labor shortage, it is going to move more slowly, and we're not going to get as much of an investment as well because of the cost of goods as well. So in order to address that, it all goes back to building our workforce. It goes back to building our housing and making sure that we are ensuring that we are making it equitable to enter these fields.
Are there any changes you'd propose to Act 250?
Well, one of the things that that's little talked about Act 250 is that the office needs to be better staffed, because people are waiting for their permits for a very long time. So that's a very somewhat simple fix, but considering workforce, it will be a little bit harder, but it hasn't been staffed since long before we had this deep workforce shortage. And so that's the first thing we need to do. In addition to that, we need to look at the system as a whole. The bill that the governor vetoed this year would have made some of these changes, and it should have. And to stall that in any way means that we are stalling progress on housing and other development. In addition, we need to make sure that people can build closer to their city centers, which is also better for our aging population and better for low-income and moderate-income Vermonters, and it's better for our climate.
Brenda, how would you handle the tremendous shortfall in the state's pension funds?
So the bill that was passed this year and then vetoed by the governor was a step in the right direction. I am hearing, and it was a true compromise between state employees, teachers, and legislators. When we look at something like that was unanimously overrode by the legislature, we have to ask, why would you put teachers and state employees under that kind of stress to feel like they are not valued by the the leader of our state by the governor. And then we have to actually move forward looking at where did we fall short in that plan? In what ways were teachers asked to carry part of this burden, and how are we going to fix that? I don't think there's an easy answer or a simple fix, but I do think that we have to, now that we've taken this first step, we need to take a look at what we do moving forward to, A, ensure it never happens again, and, again, B, ensure that our teachers and state employees are being paid what they are worth and that they are being treated with respect, the respect that they deserve.
What threat do you see to Vermont with climate change, and what can the state do to mitigate that?
Climate change is a serious issue. We are not moving towards meeting our goals from the Global Warming Solutions Act because the bill that really addressed that the most this last year, the Clean Heat Standard, was vetoed. In order to move towards that, we have to increase public transit, increase access to electric vehicles, although we need to remember that we're not going to fix this one electric vehicle at a time. We need to help our small farms transition to carbon sequestration, and we need to require our large polluters to pay their fair share and transition. We need to ensure that we are building in-state renewable energy because we get most of our energy from out of state, and in very little time, that is going to be a very high cost to Vermonters. We know that's going to happen because as soon as our contract runs out, we're going to end up with a much higher cost. And so we need to start building that in-state renewable energy and access to it as well. Those are just a few of the things that we need to do to ensure that we are moving to meet our climate goals. And I would say that top of the list is stop vetoing climate bills.
You want to ensure that all policies passed do not harm our marginalized communities. How is that accomplished?
You have to look at whenever we look at legislation inside the legislature before it's passed and when it gets to the governor's desk, we have to ask who it helps and who it hurts. If we look at that legislation and who we've left behind or who we've harmed with it is our most marginalized communities, the people we depend on frequently for our health care, the people we depend on for our groceries. You know, when we look at that, we have to be able to say, are we helping these communities? Because unless we all rise, we are not actually going to solve any of the crises that we've talked about today. The pandemic was a crisis that we all experienced, but it was not the only or the first crisis. There was already a housing shortage. There was already an overdose crisis. There was already a mental health crisis. There was already a climate crisis, and we need leadership on those issues.
We've got about 30 seconds left. What would you say has been the greatest accomplishment of your life so far?
I would say that in this past winter, there's many, but in this past winter, ensuring that over 2,000 people didn't freeze to death outside, that would be the greatest accomplishment politically and personally, of course, raising my children.
Brenda Siegel of Newfane is an anti-poverty activist who's running in the Democratic primary for governor. And to learn more about her candidacy, you can visit brendaforvermont.com. Brenda Siegel, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
All right, have a great day. We're going to take a break for CBS News for an update, and then we'll hear from photographer Ethan Hubbard, who's been all over the world and all over Vermont. And the Sox get another day off for the All-Star break, so we've got ESPN Radio at 5:30, Jazz with George Thomas at 7, and Eye on the World with John Batchelor at 9. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. The Dump Studio is going to get mighty crowded this hour. Acclaimed photographer Ethan Hubbard is joining me, and he's bringing along hundreds of Vermonters that he met and photographed over 50 years of... of traveling. Are you not hearing anything, yeah, Ethan? Okay. Of traveling our state's highways and byways. He's captured these stunning faces in his new book, True North, Rural Vermonters, 1960 through 2010. And he joins me now, Ethan Hubbard. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick.
And listeners, to ask Ethan about his amazing portraits of your friends and neighbors, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can always email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ethan, do you remember what your first camera was?
Oh, I mean, back when I was 11, it was a Brownie box camera, mm-hmm, that you look down by your belly button, and I cut my teeth on that. But for good stuff, I was 21, Canon AE-1 wide-angle T-Max, or it hadn't been invented, Tri-X film 400.
Oh, wonderful. Did you immediately take to photography, or was there some moment years into it, at some point in your life, that really solidified your interest as something more than a hobby?
I worked with the Vermont Historical Society for 10 years. I was a deputy director, and they handed me a Nikon camera and film, and I could get out of the office anytime I wanted by saying, I'm going out with my camera and my tape recorder, and they would say, go for it.
Oh, I love it. Now, was that your first photography gig?
Absolutely.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
The great Tom Slayton wrote the foreword to your 2020 book, which is Salt of the Earth. I want you to read a little from that, which will give a little more background on who you are, Ethan Hubbard.
Ethan sought his subjects' souls, and often he connected with them so deeply that he saw in their eyes his own eyes and felt in their hearts a deep connection with his own heart. Quote, more than anything, he writes, I wanted to know what people felt, breathing air, falling in love, making mistakes, everything. So he sought out simple working people in place after place, country after country. And what he found is that the common people are anything but common. My work is filled with extraordinary adventures and deep insights into a world overlooked or pushed aside by most comfortable Americans. I'm a little embarrassed to read this paragraph.
But the
irony is that Ethan himself came from that world and consciously cast it aside. Go, Ethan, to follow his vision of what life should be. Born into a well-to-do Connecticut family, he realized early on that he was not made for the country club life. That trip to Vermont may have been an early manifestation of his Huck Finn urge to break away. He sought out a different path.
Well, Tom Slayton, it's got to be an honor to have Tom Slayton write about you. Talk about, he references something from earlier on, 12 years old, you coming to Vermont. Tell people about that.
It was the underpinnings for all the travels. I did a lot of traveling this lifetime, I'm happy to announce. But the first trip, I lived in Connecticut and with my parents and siblings. And one day, a dream came into my head. As a 12-year-old boy, I thought, I want to see Vermont. I want to see this magical image, vision in my mind in person. And so I packed my Schwinn bike heavy, heavy, heavy with tent and pots and pans, and I pedaled 95 miles from Litchfield, Connecticut to Pownall, Vermont in one day. It took me 13 hours. It was a preposterous adventure because I wasn't trained in biking. I was small, 95 pounds and under 5 feet. And I camped out exhausted up in Pownall 13 hours. And then the next day I pedaled home. And that was my first trip. And from that, I have taken strength to go a lot of places in the world.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You have traveled the world as a photographer. What is it that took you to all these wonderful places?
Oh, my God. I started realizing that we can be artists. And when we look into the eyes of someone in Guatemala, that was my first big trip, that I lived in a Mayan Indian village with no cars. It only had dugout canoes, and I used my high school Spanish. And I got I bought a little casita for $750, thatched roof, a dirt floor, and all the Mayan children would come in. I had a poster of the Beatles. I had a poster of King Kong holding the woman on an Empire State Building. And the children loved it. That was my first. I went for two winters there. And so I just realized I'm going to go for it.
Wow. All right. Now, I'm going to switch to this new book, which is True North, Rural Vermonters, 1960 through 2010. What got you started photographing Vermonters over 60 years ago? Was it the Historical Society?
Yes, but it was one person in particular. I was a neighbor. I lived in a teepee on Harry Smith's land. He had 125 acres in the valley of the Mad River, and he was a dyed-in-the-wool Vermonter, never married, never had a car, never went to a dentist, never had a bank, never went, did, he had original mind, whatever that is. I like that expression. He had original mind. He was untainted, no television. He was untainted by what all of us got colored with.
Sure.
And he was a hired man for the Von Trapp farm. And, I started photographing him in 1960. One of the first shots, he had an infected tooth and he took a pry tooth hammer and yanked it out of his mouth and threw the tooth into the gutter and said, "Hi, I'm Harry Smith."
On page 66 of the book, it's Harry Smith and Zip Zip.
Zip Zip the cat. He had 11 cats.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, what a wonderful story. All right. Now, this book is self-published, but I've got to say, the paper, the printing are exquisite.
I agree.
Right? So
Vellante.
Tell us about
Vellante and Milton.
No kidding.
Yeah, amazing company.
Yeah. I mean, I used to work in the ad business, and to print something with that texture of paper and that quality of photographs is not an easy thing.
These are all, by the way, if Rick hasn't told you, black and white.
Yeah.
And I shot – it's all film, and I never went digital. And
and they go from 1960 to 2010. So how did you preserve – the film from 1960 that can still look wonderful
it
in
does.
2022.
I have. I took 5,000 rolls of film this lifetime, 600 in Vermont, and they're still good. And I still have a dark room and still print.
Wow, that's really incredible. Now, I want you to bring back these beautiful souls who you've captured on film and brought out in this book. And so this is how we're going to do it. I'm going to bark out names and page numbers if you want to refer to them.
Okay.
And then I want to hear their stories. So selfishly, I'm going to start on page 138, and that's Ray Burke, who had a WDEV connection.
Yeah.
And yeah, you page on. Yeah, 130.
No, come on. Here it is.
There he is.
Ray Burke is still alive. He must be 87. He's totally blind. And he went blind slowly. He used to work for the highway department.
Right.
And he'd say, "Well, we got some ice down in Royalton. You better be careful on 113 down there." And he just, he was like Mitch Wortley or something. He was in our lives.
Yeah.
So Ray Burke farms still. Blind, and he still milks cows, grains heifers, uses a chainsaw. Blind. He puts one radio on one brush pile, another radio on the other brush pile. One's on WDEV, one's WDOT, and he gets his bearing through the airwaves to go home or go to the next tree. I write at the end, I said, "I would go through any nor'easter with my friend. I would live in a cardboard box with scant rations if Ray Burke were there. I would climb Camel Stump backwards in winter with no shoes or no socks if Ray were leading. I would endure blindness, I believe, if Ray Burke was by my side. He is the most remarkable man I have ever known."
Oh, wow. What?
He used to hitchhike. Blind.
Oh, my goodness.
And played in a jazz band. Blind.
I still can't believe he's using a chainsaw out there.
A chainsaw.
Well done, Ray. Now, I'm gonna really make this difficult for you. I could have done them in like, order.
Oh,
but
no.
You're going to hop around.
Okay.
I want you to go to page 60 and tell us about Theron Boyd.
Theron Boyd. You've got to imagine with a picture.
Where are you there?
87. this is the fly in the ointment. This man is 81 years old, and he didn't bring his glasses in, but here I am with Theron Boyd. Theron Boyd is in bib overalls beside a 1785 Federal clapboard weather-beaten house in Queechy, Vermont, surrounded by golf clubs and real estate people. And he wouldn't sell. He never married. He had a thick Vermont accent. His magnificent federal home was still without electricity or a telephone or indoor plumbing. One day, Theron invited me into his home for dinner. He carefully prepared a meal of cold tongue, beet greens, new potatoes in a milk gravy, and a drink called switchel, water spiked with vinegar and molasses or maple syrup. While we ate, Theron talked about the developers and the real estate agents who were trying to pry him off his farm for a second house home complex they wanted to build.
Did he ever sell?
He never sold. He said, why, we never pulled them kind of shenanigans back when my mother and father were alive. Them kind of corporation liars and scoundrels just weren't around when I was young. But I'll tell you one thing, I'll never sell to them, never. This is my house and my meadow. I know just how the moon comes up through them trees. No one's going to take that from me.
Oh, my goodness.
They had a song. Some wonderful hippie banjo player made a song called The Ballad of Theron Boyd. And in the old days at Craftsbury and Danville, when they sang that song, we all got out of our lawn chairs, The Ballad of Theron Boyd and How He Never Sold.
Oh, my gosh. We've got to find that sometime. And let's head to Faiston and talk with Cindy. Hi, Cindy. How you doing?
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I have a little addition to Ethan's story. I met him. I used to live next door to Martin and Kelly, well, the Von Trapps, and I used to see Harry Smith.
Oh.
He used to milk cows, and I would watch him walk from his big old farmhouse there over to the farm and twice a day and help with milking with the cows. And every now and then I'd see him because I would go up there and I'd go and get fresh milk and you know, I was friends with Martin and Kelly and their kids, my kids. And so Harry Smith was quite a character, a very sweet man and very, you know, diligent and did his job and just a nice guy in his house, big old house, old farmhouse. And I believe he was born there. And I don't know if this is correct, but he was like mom put him in a drawer.
Oh, yeah. Cindy, I'm going to let Ethan tell the rest of that story because I think he knows this quite well.
His mother's, I think, came from Ireland, and she was named Mary Mackay. And Harry was 2 pounds at birth in a house that didn't have much heat. And so Mary Mackay put her new son in a shoebox into the warming oven of probably a Glenwood E cook stove. And that's where 2 pounds of fighting flesh emerged as the dear man that you saw walking. He walked everywhere. He walked until he died. He died at 88 in 1988. He was the greatest man in Ray Burke was great too, but Harry was, I adopted him as my grandfather.
All right. Well, great story. Thanks for letting us know about that, Cindy. Okay, page 16, I want you to tell us about the beautiful Harry Belknap.
Oh, my God. Forrest Belknap.
Or Forrest, I'm sorry.
Yes. Oh, Forrest. The picture is of Forrest bare-chested. He was a Canadian, 6'4", and he's about 50 years old. He's got a double-bitted axe, and he's with logging, and he has no shirt on, and his chest is filled with tobacco juice on his chin, down his chest. And he says, I chop trees and shag brush. That's what I do. $1.75 an hour. Trailer's cold, the wife nags, and our boy don't work. I just like to be alone in the woods.
I love it. And it is one of the best pictures in the entire book.
Thank you so much.
It is so beautiful.
He was a great friend of mine.
Oh, no kidding.
I had a wagon. He said, oh, we got to go for a ride today. And he gets in the wagon. We have to, he says, let's pick up your boy at school. And we pull into the dooryard of a one-room schoolhouse. The horse rears up. Forrest is drunk. He's got tobacco juice all over him. My son in the window shrinks so he can't be seen. And Forrest yells out, hi-ho, Silver!
Oh, amazing. Oh. All right. You're going to go to page 48 next, and we're going to talk about Gert and Bert Lifford.
Bert and Gert Lifford.
Lifford, I'm sorry.
And okay. They are from Chelsea. Both of them are deceased, as most of the people are now.
Yeah.
So back when Chelsea held 100 farms in the valley of the first branch of the White River, young Bert Lifford took up farming, same as his older brother, same as his father and grandfather. But when he met his lifelong sweetheart, Gertrude Doyle, he knew he had to make more money than his 10 cows could produce. So he took up logging and became a lumberjack. We had a good life with our cows and lumber. We loved each other from the very first start, but we also fought and quit quite a bit, like everyone does. Then the little three-line poem. Gertrude is laughing hysterically. Bert's looking skeptical.
This is in the photo, yeah.
And this is what one of them says. Why, Gert, you don't actually think your joke was that funny? And she retorts, well, Bert, it sure beat yours.
All right. Oh, I love them. It's your turn now. I'm going to let you pick one because I've got a whole list of people I want you to talk about.
Okay.
But I'm going to let you pick somebody you really
want to
tell us about.
I love long walks. And I've been here 60 years. I came as a boy. No, I came as a boy on my bicycle, but I came and taught school in 1960. So here's a picture of Evelyn and Reggie Page in Holland, Vermont. They're farm people, old. I say, I enjoyed long-distance hikes from my home in Washington. Johnny Appleseed adventures with something like a pot on my head to keep out the rain and a gunny sack to hold my toothbrush and a change of clothes. My longest trip was up to Canada, 100 miles through the woods and fields, whistling tunes and singing made-up songs. Sometimes I would walk backwards. And this is a little poem. I stayed with friendly folks who offered me haylofts and creeks to bathe in. In Holland, she welcomed me at her door. Well, stop a spell and rest your feet. Supper's on. Do spend the night. Her husband, who had this can they were spitting tobacco juice in, her husband told his truth. Christ, you look like something the cat dragged in. Bet you was a hippie.
All right, I'm going to send you deep into the book, page 244. We're going to a barbershop, I think, in Randolph.
Right.
And the photo is of George Rye and Wes Herwig. Is Wes any relation to Mim Herwig?
Yes, dear Mim.
Oh.
She was good. So was Wes.
To meet Mim before she passed.
Yeah, and she was a poet.
Oh, she was brilliant, a historian and just
great
lovely.
Great historian.
Yeah.
George Rye is cutting Wes Herwig's hair. George Rye was an old-fashioned barber who could use a straight-edge razor to give a patron a close and soothing shave. He was known as the best barber in Orange County. I accompanied my friend Wes Herwig to shop and took a seat. Regular Wes, or do you want some of the top off and sides? Looks a little long, don't it? Your Mim ever complain? Wes was a good friend of mine. He was also a trustee of the Vermont Historical Society and often went to bat for me when my work on gathering oral histories and period photographs for the museum. Wes was a sign painter by trade. A little poem. You know, George, Reed Brothers Circus used to have me paint signs for the circus. Circus coming to town. Dates and times. I was hired to be with the advance team. And then as George trimmed and straightened Wes's sideburns, the two of them would return to a bygone time when the circus came to Randolph. They were very poetic in their speech, very caring to share what they remembered. It gave me a great pleasure to sit and listen.
Mm. So as you were doing, going around, I mean, would you go back to the same people, you know,
so often.
Oh, yeah.
So often. They're children and grandchildren of people.
Yeah.
I know two families that I've known, well, certainly five generations. And if a little girl, and if I live that long, it will be six generations.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh. And how exciting was it for you to get out? I know you just wanted to get out of the office, but.
Oh, so it was my life. It was my life, too. Because these are people, these are rural Vermonters, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, maybe a 10th generation, maybe an Allen was in there, who were born before television. And some of the people, like one woman, I used to look in the obituaries when I taught at Harwood, and I would see a obituary that said she was born in 1879. So I went to see her, and she said, yeah. I was born 14 years after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated.
Wow.
And I'm going, wow, this is a privilege.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my gosh. And I'm just going to ask you a quick question before you go to the break. Now, the name is True North, and there's a kind of a tilde or an enya over the U. Yeah. Any reason for that
True? My graphic designer loves it. I love it because it's unique.
Yeah.
I actually have forgotten what the reason was.
I didn't know if I needed to say like True North or if there was some special pronunciation that I was missing. Ethan Hubbard has photographed hundreds of Vermonters and captures their incredible images in his new book, True North, Rural Vermonters, 1960 through 2010. We're going to break for CBS News, but Ethan is sticking around until 11. So if you'd like to get in the queue to speak with him, you can call us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And coming up this morning at 11, we'll have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Photographer Ethan Hubbard has done an amazing public service for the state of Vermont, capturing the images and stories of many Vermonters. In 2020, he published Salt of the Earth Among Rural and Indigenous Peoples, 1960 through 2010, which included a section on Vermont. Now he's expanded that into True North, Rural Vermonters, 1960 through 2010. The book contains the faces and stories of so many of our friends and neighbors here in the Green Mountain State. And Ethan is with me this hour sharing their photos and their stories. If you'd like to ask him about his work or about the people he's met along the way, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. And Ethan, the book is not everywhere. It's kind of elusive. So how do people find
it
this wonderful
book? It just
came
out, and I'm not in it for the money per se. I like money, but I'm not in it for the money. There's Bridgeside Books in Waterbury is carrying them, and Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, and Will's Store in downtown Chelsea carries it. And if you call me at 802-685-2025, I'll talk to you how you can get a book, and it's not expensive.
All right. I love it. All right. So Bridgeside Books in Waterbury, Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, the Will Store in Chelsea, or you can call Ethan 802-685-2025. Let's head to Marshfield. We've got Lawrence on the line, so you better get those headphones back on there. All right, Lawrence, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, Rich. Hi, Ethan. I wanted to tell a Harry Thompson story from Cabot.
Yep.
He passed away at 98 in 2013. He was an amazing person. And he was an auctioneer and a collector, some person, you know, and his yard was just full of all kinds of stuff and junk and all kinds of wonderful things. Mm-hmm. And one year, I think it was like 78, Adele and Tom Kennedy in Marshfield were cooking on the Priscilla, which was a wood stove from the 1896, and a peace broke. And so Tom went over there, and Harry's got a big pot of water boiling where he's taking feathers off a chicken and all kinds of commotion with the three kids and the wife. And Tom says, Harry, do you got this part? And he says, I think I do. And he picks up his bucket of boiling water, walks outside, and there's a huge amount of snow everywhere. And he walks over to the certain spot in the pile of all the stuff, and he pours the hot water down, and there was this part right there.
Oh, Lawrence, that's beautiful. Thanks so much for that memory. And that'll send us to page 124, where a wonderful picture of Harry Thompson is.
Harry's holding two of his 14 chihuahuas. He should have been our president. He was the most conscious person I've ever known. This is a quote from my story. I watched as Harry rose from the table with the grace of a ballet dancer and went to a small back room more congested than any other of the house. He returned a few minutes later with a barn lantern that I had wanted, and then he pressed into my hand a small silver locket on a delicate chain. Quote, this belonged to my mother. I thought you might like to take it. I was there at the eulogy at his service in Marshfield, and people got one up after another, and they said, typical expression was, you know, I can't do a woman's accent. You know, we had bags of groceries left on our back porch year after year. Well, by God, old Harry was a Robin Hood in disguise.
Oh, I love it. Well, speaking of women, let's go to page 12, early on in the book. And I just love her photo, Hazel Smith. I want you to tell us.
Oh, isn't she something?
Oh, God, yes. Page 12.
Okay, so Hazel is a wild hair old lady, just a face like a road map.
Yep. And tells so much.
Hazel says this. Hazel, probably 80, Hazel would escape from the nursing home in Chelsea and come down to the country store and act goofy. Some people pretended that she didn't exist, but if I was there, I perked up and joined right in the fun. Sometimes Dave and Beth Farnham, the owners, would us and asked for decorum, but I think they enjoyed the liveliness. I know they did. Here's the poem. I don't know if I'm pretty, but I sure like my heart. Want to play tag? And then I continue. Hazel and I would greet the patrons coming through the door. Oh, Miss Gert Ginny Button, you have just won the door prize of 2 bananas for being the 1,000th customer. And then we have another poem. Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Oh, I love it. Oh, man, this has got to be, like, just the most exciting thing for you when you got this published and were able to collect all the great photographs you've taken over those 50 years.
I wanted to do, among other things, I'm 81 and I'll die sometime soon, and I wanted an album of these people that touched my heart.
Yeah.
They're my best friends.
All right. Well, let's go to page 22 and tell us about Harold Codfish Clough.
Oh, Harold.
Clough, right?
What a great name.
I know.
What a great name.
I'm not sure if I love the name or the photograph more.
Page
22. Page 22.
Okay. So Harold Codfish. He was from Montpelier, Barrie. Harold Codfish Clough was one of my most favorite people. He was a thoughtful, kind man. Every now and then, I would run into him at Miss Pompilier Diner. Sitting at the counter, Harold would inevitably call over to me as I walked in. Have you had your second cup of coffee? The second cup of coffee business was what I loved about the man. In his simple query, with his beady eyes staring directly into my soul, he wasn't asking about coffee, but about life, a little poem. My second cup of coffee with Codfish at the diner would propel me into the present moment.
Oh, I love that. Oh, my. You said that you probably wouldn't have the same energy this morning that you had when you did. You had this wonderful talk at the Highland Center for the Arts, and it's online. I got to watch it. It was fabulous. But that same energy is with you right now. I can tell every time you turn to a page, you hear a name, you see the picture, it all comes right back to you. So now I know this is another favorite of yours. He's on page 42, and I'm hogging it up. I'm not even giving you many choices of your own.
No.
But I think you love Orlando Braemann.
Orlando Braemann, he's 90, and he asked me to marry his daughter at the podium in Barrie, downtown Barrie. She married Alfred Avery, and so I was the minister. So here he is at 90 with a big sheepskin cap on and glasses and a big grin. And this is what I said about Orlando Braemann. It's in a poem form. Orlando never owned a car, never wanted one. He only rode bicycles. We saw him in town working at Will's store, bottles and cans and such. When he pedaled down Main Street to go home for his dinner, we would often stop just in our tracks and say to ourselves, "Wow, look, it's Orlando on his bike."
We've got John joining us from Waterbury Center. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rick. Ethan, this has been fantastic hearing about your connection with various folks from around Vermont and their ties that you've investigated and reported on. I was curious about yourself, though. You said you only came up here as a youth on a bicycle from Connecticut, but with a name like Ethan, you have to have some Vermont roots.
I tell you, it's
John Walter, well done.
You found me out. My real name is Walter. I was Wally for 35 years until I went, "Hey, I'm in the Green Mountain State. Ethan Allen rode his horses from Connecticut to Vermont. I'm going to be Ethan."
Oh, well done. Oh, so you said, "I'm going to be a Vermonter one way or another. I'm going to take all these pictures, and I'm going to change my name to Ethan." I love it. All right, let me see. I know you love these guys. Page 38, early in the book, and we're going to talk about Norm Fletcher and John Doyle on page 38. I know John Doyle's one of your faves, too.
38.
You know,
I'm gonna tell the joke at the end, but I think I can do it.
Is it clean?
It's okay.
Carry on. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
John Doyle was my neighbor for 18 years. He lived in an old swayback house with his wife, Virginia. He was one of the Doyles, one of the four suits of the deck in Chelsea. He probably weighed 260, 270, and he's standing with Norm Fletcher from Montpelier, and they used to work together. As a matter of fact, Norm had a drop John Doyle back in the front end of a loader of a machine because he was soused. They had been haying together. So the little story I wrote is this. I took Norm and John for pie and coffee at the Chelsea Diner. They had worked together decades earlier. And so Norm says, "Hell," he said in a high nasally voice, "remember how we got drunk while hanging along the river and I had to deliver you back to your wife in a front end loader? Weren't your Ginny madder than hell? Didn't you sleep in the doghouse for a night or two?" And then a little story, a little poem below. Norm begins another story as they dive into lemon meringue pie. They laugh so deeply that the walls shake, as do their bellies. Even the lemon slices jiggle on the plates.
Oh, gold. And he had absolute gold.
I've got to tell the joke.
Go ahead.
So I said to John, he was tongue-tied. He had a cleft palate. He said, "Ethan, take me to the eye doctor. I had tear down my eye." I said, "I'd be glad to take you to the oculist." We're driving to Barrie. He says he has to pee, gets out, pees, doesn't turn from the road. He's pees like, and then he comes back into the car. He said, "I don't know why I got tear coming down my eye all the time." I said, "John, I know why you have tears running down your face. You've been having too much sex with your wife. It will do it to you every time." At which point he said with a wink in his eye, "If that be true, you ought to be blind."
That's as racy as we get here on Vermont Viewpoint. All right. We have some time. I want to get to some of my all-time favorite photos in the whole book. So page 108, and it's Zeke Karen. Page 108.
It's a nice story.
Yeah.
108. Come on,
Ethan. Yeah, take your time there. Everybody's waiting for you.
Okay. Zeke Karen was a French Canadian from Barton, or as they say, Batten. And Zeke Karen was a blacksmith, like a Longfellow character. His hammer rang, his bellows raged. He cussed in French and spat on the floor. I always reflect on what I had known and loved when I was young and carefree in my beloved Vermont. I now drive past Zeke Karen's old-fashioned blacksmith shop, and it's boarded up. He's gone, and Barton children can't bring their rusted frame bike to have it put back together or to linger and watch the sparks fly up like stars. The doors were often open back then, and the aroma of pungent coal grease was like holy incense from the Eastern Orthodox Church. And then Zeke might call out to you in French to enter and welcome. Sometimes other blacksmiths and farriers might appear to help Zeke with a complicated job. Lyndon Liberty from Island Pond, Frank Patwin from Hardwick, Francis Foster from Alden. Their role was to take metal hooks to lift the scalding wagon rim out of the fire and carry it to the water tub for cooling. Four strong men toiled as one. With their success, a great shout and huzzah echoed through Zeke's shop. Last sentence. In the end, the old ways of Vermont disappeared like faint holy smoke into the sky and were gone. Mere memories held by a few. It's always this way in the world.
I feel like I know Vermont so much better after spending an hour with you. I want you to go to page 178, and I just love this. Three gentlemen at the feed store.
And they all have big bellies and flat shirts.
This is so Vermont. So very Vermont.
Three gentlemen at the feed store. Oh, this is the story I just read.
Oh, is it really?
I'm not going to read it again.
Oh, okay.
This is about, if that be true, you ought to be blind.
Oh, okay. All right. You don't have to tell that one again. Oh, but it's a beautiful photo of the three of them.
I'll just read the first line.
Okay.
Not the joke.
Okay.
These are three of my friends. Norm Fletcher used to make me birdhouses, and Gordy Hayward used to bring me a truckload of manure every spring. John Doyle was simply my closest neighbor for 18 years.
Wonderful. All right. Let's give the author's choice again. You can pick one that you really want to tell us about. Maybe that's very special to you.
Can I say shit from Shinola?
No. No. You just did. You can't.
They didn't hear me. This is a logger named Herb Gomes. He's standing beside probably a 1959 flatbed truck with logs on it. He lives alone in the woods. Herb Gomes, the logger, lived in a small cabin at the edge of a scrawny thicket of scrub hemlock and spruce. He was rough on the outside, but soft as pudding on the inside. When he allowed himself to half smile, the whole world would lighten up. I shagged brush for Herb one bitterly cold day on Bar Hill. He was cutting hemlock with a McCulloch chainsaw, but when the sun hid behind Buffalo Mountain, the temps dropped to nine below. We headed back down to a light in the cabin on Caspian Lake. Herb fried up some salt pork on a cook stove. He opened two cans of beans and two bottles of beer. One of his hounds sniffed around his legs. Herb cautiously snipped off a piece of meat and fed it to him. The wind whistled around the eaves of the cabin. Herb looked sadly at the thermometer and groaned. I asked him why he stayed at it. He looked at me with those beautiful, half-sad, half-mirthful eyes and said, "I like how it is. How could it be otherwise?"
I know you enjoyed, I think, every shutter click, over those 50 years and taking these photographs and getting to know these people. But what was it like, when you'd approach them and want them to pose for a photograph? How easy was it to get people?
Easy.
It was.
It's like fly fishing or playing tennis, because you just practice and you fall down a lot. You fall down a tremendous amount of times asking to take a picture of someone. But then you develop you believe in yourself and you believe in the art of photography. And I always got pictures back to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I made the tape recordings go. There were 100 of them went to the Vermont Folklife Center. Mm. They knew that something good was going to come. And I just had a lot of confidence and joking, and it worked.
Yeah. Was there one specific subject who just loved to who loved the camera, just couldn't wait to?
Frank Foster.
He was very quickly.
Yeah, I'm going to do it quickly. Frank Foster. He's in standing in this coffin. He made his coffin.
Oh, right.
Francis Foster was a man of the soil, with manure on his boots, dirt under his fingernails, and sawdust in his pockets, as his daughter Crystal often said. Sometime before Frank passed away in 2011, he jumped up from the breakfast table and said, "Well, by God, if I'm going in the ground soon, then I'm going to make me a custom-made coffin to feel more to home." Little poem. "Just right, by Jesus. A pine box, iron hinges, and no fanfare. Sure beats Pan and Undertaker, don't it?"
Frank Foster. All right, so photographer Ethan Hubbard's new book is called True North, Rural Vermonters, 1960 through 2010. It's available here in Waterbury, Bridgeside Books, in Montpelier at Bear Pond Books, and in Chelsea at Will's Store. Or you can call Ethan directly at 802-685-2025. Ethan, I want to thank you so much for sharing this true Vermont gem with us this morning. It has been my pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Rick.
All right. And I want to thank that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed again by that tag team of Lee Cattell and Stephen Tanzi. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Zingary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we learn about the Vermont Prize, Rutland Magazine, the Maple Roots Festival, and the Stowe Jazz Festival.